This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
I want to present Ceren Kulkul. Ceren is a postdoctoral researcher at the Migration Research Center at Koch University. And she has her PhD from Humboldt University. Previously, she has studied sociology and media and cultural studies at the Middle East Technical University in Ankara. Ceren published her dissertation in this book, Turkish Muslim Women in Berlin, Navigating Boundaries in the City. And we are very much looking forward to hearing about it.
Thank you so much, Christine. And I'm very happy to be in this Think and Drink session. I once was a regular audience of Think and Drink sessions while I was doing my PhD at Humboldt a few years ago. And as Christine also mentioned, that this is my dissertation that I wrote at Humboldt University. 2 years ago, I finished it. And in the last 2 years, I have been working in this project to turn it into a book. And it's finally here. And I'm happy to share the findings and the research with you today. I usually start with some narratives to this whole discussion of community building practices of women in Berlin. I will move on with the first one, a young woman from the field. Feyza was 28 years old when I did my research in Berlin, and she was born in Germany and she has a German passport. She's married and she has 2 children. She has a degree in psychotherapy. She was spending her weekends at the mosque at that time, mostly. And she believes that the most precious asset in her life was her faith. So she said, "We were raised in Germany. We could have lived in a very different way. Luckily, my parents taught us our culture, our religion." And another woman, Ella, was also 28 years old, and she was born in Kreuzberg, Berlin. She's a German citizen, she's married, she's a university graduate, and she told me that she's a true Berliner when I asked her how she would define herself. And she also said, "I don't belong to a religion. My mother reads the Quran, my father fasts and performs Islamic prayer, but that's all. I didn't join a Quran course, for example, when I was a child." And the third narrative by Melike, who was 24 years old at that time. Like Ella, she was born in Kreuzberg. She has dual citizenship, both Turkish and German. She was not married at that time. She was doing her master's by then. And she shared a memory with me. It was the month of Ramadan, she said. Some Muslim friends of mine hosted a fast-breaking meal, iftar, in a church, both for Muslims and non-Muslims. If I ever tell this to my granny, she will categorize this as a sin right away. If you ask me, there's no problem. My truth is entirely different. So I like to start with these three narratives because these narratives show how religious observance might differ. They are almost at the same age. They all hold German citizenship one way or another. They have Turkish backgrounds, Turkish families. They are all third generations of their migrant families, and they are graduates of higher education. They have been living in Berlin since their childhoods. And as you can see, their stories and their identifications don't match not only with each other, but also with existing approaches on various processes of identification. So migration flow from Turkey to Germany is a well-known one. Began in the 1960s. And an extensive literature on Muslims in European cities also is a well-known and huge literature on how religious organizations are regulated, how guest workers brought their families to Europe, how family reunification happened, and so on and so forth. So the book is all about figuring out actually how to approach these phenomena from a different angle, how to see these differences that I mentioned at the beginning of this presentation. So it aims to amplify these parts of the story. And the first one, the first theme or topic that I would like to address is religiosity. There's a rarely an emphasis on the heterogeneity in religious affiliation of Muslims, especially in the European framework. But religious observance of Muslims is very different, although it's insufficiently analyzed in the literature. And the second one is that the influence of space was not yet described in the detailed literature of Turkish Muslims in Berlin. Although some studies have mentioned ethnic enclaves, such as Kreuzberg being a little Istanbul, but this is not accurate anymore, and this is not up-to-date information that we can say with the changing structure of Kreuzberg. But still, the majority of Turkish Muslims' studies only remained in this way and insufficient in connecting urban inequalities and urban space use, social boundaries of this minority group. And the third one is about gender. I saw that women's practices are almost invisible in the existing literature on Turkish Muslim communities in Europe. All guest workers' discussion goes back and forth between men's experiences, men's struggles, and so on, because the first comers were mostly men. And some other literature only analyze faith-based organizations as structural units, which is really important to see, but these organizations are run by men mostly rather than women. So these studies remain gender blind as well. Or some of them analyzed these structures with a macro analysis perspective, that they don't possibly grasp the significance of daily acts and practices of women. So what I aimed for in this book was to investigate these understudied themes in the long-lasting Turkey-Germany migration phenomenon, to look from the perspective of women to their everyday lives, of women themselves through their narratives. And accordingly, I ask, how do women of Turkish origin in post-secular Berlin construct cultural religious routines? And I look to different routines and urban space use, like access to resources, social and cultural capital, boundary work, transnational identification, and so on and so forth. Of course, I will not be able to touch upon all of these. I will only briefly mention some of those, but in the book, if you're interested, you can see all these questions are trying to be addressed. So I start with the argument that cities today are post-secular cities, post-secular. Various scholars debated that religions revived as a significant feature of the recent decades and of this century. So these scholars aim to show that religions are recurring to be a way of representing social identities within the urban space, and religions not only like Islam, Christianity, but also a way of religious or spiritual thinking is recurring to be a way of our representations. So in the era of rationality, people continue to be affiliated with faith in one way or another in this view. And I always give the example of, I also put this in the book as well. In a country like Turkey, for example, where the majority of population is identified themselves as Muslims, even I myself don't practice prayers, I would still hear the call to prayer from a mosque nearby 5 times a day. If you ever visit Istanbul or any other Turkish city, you would also hear that. This is a very simplified example for sure, but in this sociopolitical scene, the religion is there in your everyday life too. So I took today's cities as post-secular cities. And the question is here is that how to grasp that heterogeneity of Muslims' religious affiliation there, how to grasp differences in the narratives that I mentioned at the beginning of this presentation. So there are two distinct directions that Islam can be understood. Maybe I can start with that first. The first one is that Islam appears as a personal or a spiritual matter, in other words, as faith. In this case, it can include religious practice or not. This kind of religious belief is morally effective usually, but not always and not necessarily socially penetrating. It is accepted as a moral compass or as an inner conscience rather than a determination of daily living or conduct. But in another way of religious affiliation or religious observance, belief is at the core of organization of one's daily routines. It is more than personal matter or spiritual matter. And the norms and rules of Islam here dominate both private and also public conduct. So Islam is not only a device of identification for these people, but also of representation. In this case, religion often becomes instrumentalized. So I argued this a lot in the book. I hope I can have a chance to also touch upon this today later in the presentation. So to go back to the main arguments, today cities are post-secular. Actually, cities are not only post-secular, but they're also transnational. In fact, they are post-secular because of the presence of transnationalism. As countries become more diverse in social, political, economic ways, we all know that migration processes gain different meanings And in many cases, particularly in migration for economic reasons, like in the cases of guest workers, migrants didn't entirely separate from their homelands. So transnational spaces are created in the host country. And transnational space is not creation of one individual or only one group, but rather transnational spaces are created collectively. And belonging to those spaces are accumulated in time, and its codes are transferred through generations. In other words, contemporary cities are inevitably transnational because there is migration. After Second World War, Germany's economy was constrained. Another well-known story, and it needed massive labor support, which couldn't be sufficiently supplied from within the country. And in Turkey at that time, there was also an economic crisis that people couldn't find jobs. So the well-recognized story of Turkish laborers in Germany started in that way, with high numbers of recruitments to various sectors of German industry. So according to literature, there are three phases of social sciences research on Turkish Muslims in Germany. First one is like at the very beginning stage, taking Turkish culture as a baggage that is carried to Germany. And then second phase of literature, more concerned about family reunification and changing demographics of Turkish migrants in Germany, in German cities. And third phase rather asks about concepts like citizenship or socioeconomic performances of Turkish migrants, descendants in schools and labor market and so on. I will pass this very briefly because I'm pretty sure that some of these numbers have also changed until now. This is from the book. But actually, migration of migrants is still rising, especially in Berlin. But there's now a new wave of migration to Berlin. They are not children or grandchildren, grandchildren of guest workers anymore. But there's a new group of people who are the first people actually in their family who migrate to Berlin from Turkey in the recent years, last 5 to 7 years. But this is something, an entirely different story, because they're running away from the oppression of Erdogan and so on. So that's something else. I will not get into detail. But overall, approximately 3 million Turks, from which half of them were born in Germany, exists there. And this fact doesn't change. Turks in Germany are known as the largest Turkish community outside of Turkey still. So this is still valid for Turkish community in Germany. And given the high numbers in population all over Germany, Turks, of course, were in search of creating opportunities and also creating places to perform their religious rituals, along with many other reasons for connecting to each other, for prayers and so on. And these people were coming from small towns and small cities of Turkey, and they're mostly identified themselves as religious, pious people. Because of this need, we have in Berlin over 80 mosques exist now, and numerous faith-based organizations that are run by Turkish foundations. Even one is from Turkish government. And I mentioned three of them, that these are three of them that which are the largest ones for many decades in the book, but I'm not going to get into the detail of these for now, because my question here in this book is not about their organization or how they are regulated and so on, as I said. This has already been mentioned by many other studies, but my question is, where are women in all those faith-based organizations and also in the everyday city life in Berlin? So we know that the majority of Turkish guest workers in Germany were male, and similarly that these religious organizations are male-dominated spaces. Women appear in two main positions in the literature on Turkish migrants to Germany. The first one is when men left their homes in Turkey to start up a new life in Germany. In this case, women were left behind with or without their children for an undetermined period of time. And the second one is that they came as brides. In Turkish, we call ital gelin, which means bride from abroad. And these two positionalities, as you can see, disguise the agency of women to a great extent. So I approach women's practices to amplify their role in this migration. And in order to analyze this, I conducted ethnography qualitative study. I use ethnography to show that urban space could be or usually is a field for struggle, exclusion, and reaction for minority women. An ethnographic study was useful to grasp the detailed aspects of everyday routines and performances they have and the ways in which they identify themselves and position themselves in German context and also within their neighborhoods. These were useful tools to understand the various ways of performing both belief and culture. Therefore, one of the primary concerns in this book, in this research, was to build a bottom-up methodological understanding of Turkish women community in Berlin, rather than starting the analysis from this label, from this whole homogeneous idea of community. As I mentioned, this was a study I conducted between 2018 to 2019. So for approximately 1 year, I conducted in-depth interviews, go-alongs while women have to pick up their children from kindergarten or school, or when they're going to groceries. And I used participant observation, obviously, to include life stories, past experiences, narratives, gossips, other personal matters and everything. So I spent hours each week at the mosque, but also in the houses of women and in family and friend gatherings. And Simple was composed of first, second and third generation women from Turkey. Either were born in Germany, came to Germany while they were children or young, or those who came relatively late to Germany with the family reunion or by marriage. So all women had Turkish parents and all were living in Berlin for over 10 years at that time. And the level of education and level of religious observance were all different. And level of religious observance and the identification that I did at the beginning of this presentation, how they see their religiosity was one of the main concerns I had. So it was basically in Wedding and Kreuzberg. And I also see that, for example, people, women in Wedding, usually distance themselves, keeping their distance from other neighborhoods like Neukölln, and Turkish people in Neukölln, and also Kurdish people in Neukölln. And they repeat this a lot during our conversations because Sunni Muslims keep this distance from Alevis. And also in many cases between Turks and Kurds, there's also this distance that you can see also in the way of using these districts and neighborhoods. I will move on with the findings, with the discussion. And that's also something I will start with this whole integration, imagining this integration debate. A whole discussion of integration, of course, has been going on since the years of family reunification law in Germany. And I believe that integration debates are missing something very important, that they couldn't grasp the very details of this everyday life. Communities are not entities. They are not static, fixed entities. Thus, Turks and Turkish women who came to Germany 60 years ago are not the same people with today's youth. For example, who were born, who were raised, schooled in German cities, and second generation and third generation are not the same. Their living situations are not the same. I will give some examples later. So I asked actually how community is built among these women by difference with all those differences. And I criticized the conceptualization of community where it is taken as a category rather than ever-changing sets of encounters and practices, and construction of communities are similar to identification or identities. They're built by reference and the meaning of this identity or meaning of community, let's say. Let's move on to community. And the meaning of community is not a single determined unity. It changes by nature. So my argument is that even two women in the same household may conceive Islam in very different terms. They may practice Islam in very different ways, whilst their culture, their nationality, level of education, sometimes age, are similar. More differentiation would create more separation in defining community. But still, this doesn't mean that they have no choice of creating this community. However, the opposite also is valid. The opposite doesn't create a unique, pure sense of belonging. Just because two women are similar to each other in terms of nationality or background, it doesn't mean that they would have this kind of belonging to each other, to this group of people that just because they're similar. So community is actually something that these women embrace in time. So they didn't embrace it the moment they land in Germany. It is something they build, they change, they sometimes replace, sometimes reinforce. So repetition, frequency, time in similar places in the city enable them to build social ties. And in this way, they both help each other, they strengthen the symbolic boundaries. I will talk about it a little bit later. So this is the making of community, and they are also negotiating their boundaries too within the group. So the community is built with boundaries, and boundaries built by using or not being able to use or obtain certain types of capitals. For example, one of the best examples of using the social capital, or also of economic capital among women, was in finding cleaning jobs. So this sector is very much disordered, and jobs in the cleaning market are mostly found in informal ways through women they know. And after finding the job with the help of their social capital, the cooperation continues among these women. For example, when one woman is not able to go to work on a weekday because, I don't know, her son needs something in the kindergarten or school, or when she has a doctor appointment, another woman, a distant relative, a friend, a family member replaces her and go to this cleaning job for the day. And they share the money for that day. And these kinds of support remain informal and usually unannounced to the employer. This is an example of how they build this cooperation and help to each other among themselves. I would like to also mention about social boundaries while speaking of boundaries and setting these kind of keeping these distances to others. Especially for second-generation Turkish guest workers who started a new life in Germany as children mostly. And they had great financial challenges and also language restrictions. So receiving a good education or continuing to higher education was not easily attainable. Although there are many reasons, such as economic factors, I argued in the book that it's not simply a lack of social or cultural capital. It is part of the coin, but on the other part, there is a structural discrimination at that moment, at that time, and the fact that they were children of migrants who tried to hold on to a new life, obviously, in a host country. But this is the story of, for example, second generation, not the third generation, because third generation is relatively lucky in that sense. But it is not saying that, oh, they're all fine because they're schooled in Germany, because there is still difficulties in finding a place in the labor market, for example. I have this example of Füsun, who was 22-year-old at that time, who was looking for a job before she started her current unpaid work as a teacher at the mosque. So she wanted to work to support her family, and she applied for various jobs in Berlin. And in a very well-known B2 shop in Berlin, the recruiter didn't accept her application because she believed that a woman with a headscarf wouldn't be desired there in a beauty shop. And she believes that this wouldn't happen if a Turkish Muslim man was an applicant or a non-Muslim person was an applicant. And she says that physical appearance is really affecting her life. But it's also, social boundaries also exist in the city. And I have two good examples about this. Some of them are set by women themselves, but also, yeah, maybe I can also give this example. So women have negative attributions to set certain neighborhoods in Berlin, to which either they don't prefer to go, or they would say they would never go. For instance, Marzahn-Hellersdorf is a place that they would never go for any reason. And the example was expressed due to the security reasons, because they believe they are Muslim identity, their appearance, a headscarf would be attacked there. Another example about use of space and boundaries, for example, women use the word our neighborhood while speaking of wedding or a place in Kreuzberg and so on, while mentioning other districts as German areas. So the original word neighborhood, mahalle in Turkish, comes from Arabic and actually means accommodation or house or housing. So this is a kind of an emotional tie there. But area, the word area remains as a neutral place where no belonging is attached. Another issue that I found really important, and I touch upon in the book in various chapters, when education doesn't provide the necessary tools for getting into the labor market and when the doors are also somehow closed to job opportunities. These women find other ways to sustain their lives or spend their time during the day. In some cases, they cannot sustain their own lives financially, but they're spending their time in other places. And women intensify their belonging as a replacement of, I said, Western way, and find new ways. And these ways construct and sustain this kind of sense of community as well. So in Germany, many Turkish women attend mosques along with their education at school from very early ages to learn the Quran. Women with ongoing religious practices at mosques later on, and those who are actively participating in religious prayers in their everyday lives, they continue to have this close friends in those circles. But those who never attended the regular meetings at mosques, for example, I mentioned at the beginning one of the examples of women, that she never go to this kind of Quran courses when she was a child. And also for those whose attendance is discontinued after a while, for those women, they do not have sustained ties with people in those circles. They find other ways, they found other social networks. But in many Berlin neighborhoods, people mostly choose the mosque they regularly visit on the basis of their membership to a faith-based organization. But they also usually prefer to attend the nearest mosque to their residence in their neighborhoods. And in some cases, the meaning of attending a mosque regularly for women moves beyond seeing the similar faces, like familiarity or engaging with similar others. But then it became a place of personal ties, so like friendships, building friendships. With regular frequent visits to mosque, religion becomes an instrument of building community in the neighborhoods in a form of social capital. In a mosque, both feeling of membership to a neighborhood community and social networks provide these women with valuable resources in other fields of their everyday lives, as I gave the example of cooperation in cleaning jobs, finding cleaning jobs, in some cases finding a new flat, and so on. But mosques also can be considered as a space of cultural capital, as it is often challenging for numerous Turkish women to complete their higher education and find a well-paid job in Germany, especially for second generation. It prevents those women from obtaining cultural capital in professional fields that labor market in Berlin and Germany requires from them. So many of those women inclined to get opportunities within the mosque or within the religious organizations. And interviews show that even the reasons change for this decision to remain in the mosque, women who chose to stay in the mosque are mostly encouraged by their families in the early ages, and they would like to stay in the community afterwards as well, in the cases that I interviewed with in Wedding and Kreuzberg. So inside the mosque and in a religious community, also a specific cultural capital is produced and also transmitted to the next generations in a systematic way through gatherings, conversations, courses, and so on. And it's not easy for an outsider, for example, as a researcher like me, to gain immediate access to this accumulated cultural capital. It requires time. And this is their way of setting the boundary with themselves to the others. And in the book, I had a large narrative of how in-group tension also exists among these women, like between families, between in-laws and brides, and between among friends and so on. I guess I will not have enough time for them right now because this is a huge other story, but these and many other examples from the field showed that communities constructed with this frequency, repetition, acceptance, negotiation, trust among women, and it is open to change in most of the time, at all times, actually. My aim, along with this whole research, was to show that detailed microanalysis fills the gap of what valuable macroanalysis on Turkish Muslim population until today suggested. And it can enable us as researchers to see that understanding and suggesting efficient ways of implementing these huge concepts, huge themes like integration, adaptation, educational, occupational performance, boundaries, and so forth, requires to look for a difference and change and heterogeneity. While today's Turkish youth is different from their grandmothers, and while religious observance national identification and even daily city use are being various. How can we claim that Turkish Muslim population is a single homogeneous unit, or Turkish women as a single unit? So this book was a hopeful attempt actually to challenge this idea. But I also always note that this book remains relatively short in discussing this cooperation, trust and support among women, especially as mothers, because many of the women that I interviewed with, I spent time with, were also mothers. And they had this various ways of taking care of their children collectively in the city. So staying together creates this set of helping practices and a practice of community at the end. So it was my aim after this book to focus on these concepts with Turkish women in Berlin. But as currently I'm settled in Istanbul, I'm changing tracks a little bit. Here I'm working with Syrian women in Istanbul, a whole different story based on their migration histories. But still, I would like to explore how women access resources in the city and form a sense of belonging community through mothering practices they have. I hope to begin this research soon in Istanbul. At the end, I would like to say that through these kind of analysis, it can also be said that cities are lived differently, and looking into various forms of living in the city is significant to have the full picture of understanding other stories as well.
Thanks a lot, Sharon, for this very interesting and insightful talk.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.